So when we talk about something like the truth of suffering, I think from the perspective of Western thought, we think of this as meaning some abstract truth of suffering. We think about karma, we think of an abstract law of karma. Any of the truths, any of the four Buddhist truths, we think about them referring to some abstract thing. Or if we talk about relative and ultimate truth, we think about them being an abstract truth. But actually, in the Buddhist tradition, Indian tradition in general, but in particular the Buddhist tradition, is very different. And so when we talk about the truth of suffering, it doesn't mean that there is some separate principle or law or whatever that is the truth of suffering. Suffering is the samsaric aggregates. This is the truth of suffering. There is no truth of suffering separate from our experience. There's no abstraction. The truth of suffering is the samsaric aggregates, because the samsaric aggregates are the basis for us to project an idea of a self. When you think of me for yourself, what do you think of? You think, well, your body, or your mind, your feelings, your thoughts, your emotions, all of this, and these are nothing other than the five aggregates. These five aggregates of grasping are actually, in their nature, they're suffering. The reason we say that they're suffering is, we talk about the three different types of suffering, right? There's the suffering of suffering. The suffering of suffering is the experience of pain or displeasure, sickness, illness, physical pain, mental pain. That's all suffering of suffering. So that's, when you say suffering, most people think of suffering. They think, oh, you got leprosy and now you're suffering. It's incredibly painful, that suffering. You got AIDS. You had to deal with this situation in your family, the whatever. You know. So you think of So when you say suffering, people think of the suffering of suffering. That is the main type of suffering that we think of, but it's not the only type of suffering there is. The second type of suffering is called the suffering of change. The suffering of change, this is where gelato and coffee fit in, if you like them. You might not find them to be pleasurable. If you don't like gelato and coffee, then they're probably just the suffering of suffering. No, don't drag me to the gelato place. But the suffering of change is that any pleasurable experience ends. It finishes, and when it finishes, then it's unhappy. We're unhappy about it. If you are in a great position, you're on the top of the world, you're a billionaire, and you lose all your money, you're going to be unhappy. People who commit suicide when the stock market crashes. That's kind of an extreme example, but we can see that. You have something good. That good thing ends, and you experience suffering. Everything good comes to an end, and so, therefore, we experience suffering. Now, they happen on various degrees. I mean, the suffering of change that comes from gelato and Arabica's mocha, double mocha, whatever. Well, it's easy to see it with coffee. You drink the coffee, for me, I drink the coffee, and 8 hours later, I have a headache. It's pleasurable when I drink it, and 8 hours later, it's a headache. You drink the coffee, and then you have to go to the bathroom really badly. you know, I mean, these are that's kind of the kind of minor examples, because frankly, and gelato and coffee are not really the main focus. But what really happens is we get focused on that object of pleasure, gelato, coffee, cigarettes, whatever, and then we do things in order to get it that cause future suffering. So we engage in actions out of greed that then will have a future karmic repercussion. Now, I mean, maybe sometimes that action out of greed might be just working harder. Probably for most of us, okay, you want to be able to afford your coffee habit, you have to work an extra hour a day because that's how much the coffee you drink costs. Well, maybe not. Maybe it's a half hour. But you have to have the resources to do it. So you will put yourself to the through the suffering of going to a job that you would not do if you had your druthers, in order to earn money to buy coffee. That's a little bit of suffering. But basically the suffering of change is when you everything changes. So right now we are in a good position. The real meaning of it is we are in a good position now, and that position is going to end. Even in this human life, we may be prosperous in this human life, it's not guaranteed that it's going to continue to the end of this human life. And when we lose our money, then we will be unhappy. When we fall from the human life to a lower realm, the animal or the hungry ghost or the hell realms, because we have not done enough virtue in this life, that is the suffering of change. That's particularly what we mean by the suffering of change. And the third type of suffering is called the pervasive suffering of formation. Now, what this refers to is the fact that everything arises and perishes in every moment. The aggregates arise and perish in every moment. That's why they're called aggregates. Like, they're all constantly being assembled, aggregating constantly. They're put together, causes and conditions coming together, and because of that, they're unstable. They're constantly shifting and changing. You can look at that with the with physical aggregates. Things may look like they are stable. But even if they look like there's something stable, you can talk to any physicist, they will tell you that the atoms in that thing that appear to be stable are actually constantly, the electrons are spinning around, the chemical bonds are being formed and broken and all this, and I don't really know it that well, but I remember enough from high school and from reading various things over the years to know that actually atoms are not stable things. And when you think about subatomic particles, it's even stranger. When you get down to quarks and quantum mechanics, it's very strange. They look to us on the surface as if things are stable and lasting, but actually, inherently, they're not. They're changing every nanosecond or even faster. When you look at your minds, you can also see the same thing, that they're always changing. They're never the same. And every moment of mind is always, it arises, it comes, it goes, it comes, it goes. Eventually, if we were to be doing the Theravada style of meditation, it's a meditation that's very effective to actually seeing this in your own mind. In the Tibetan tradition, we don't do that sort of meditation as much, and so it's more difficult in the Tibetan tradition to see this. But there are a lot of stories of people in recent times, people such as yourselves, who have followed the course of meditation in the Theravada tradition, and they have realized the impermanence of all phenomena. They've actually seen the impermanence of all phenomena. And their descriptions of people, what was his name? Sayadaw, wasn't the Burmese master who taught in the 1950s in Burma and then came over here in the 70s. And I think he was associated with the IMS in Barrie. He taught quite a bit in Burma, and many of his students in Burma achieved the state of stream enterer, which means that they, by following his meditation, they were able to actually see the transient nature of every phenomena. But we don't see it on a daily level. So for us, it's like, maybe it's kind of intellectual, but this is actually, it takes a lot of work to put it together. It's suffering, because it's arising and perishing in every single moment, the nature that is just inherently painful for us. This is suffering that is so subtle that we're so unaware of. It's like the difference between having a hair in your palm. You can hardly feel it. But for someone who actually perceives it, for a noble being who actually perceives it, it's like having that hair in your eyeball. It's so difficult. It's unbearable. You feel like you have to get that hair out of your eye. This is the pervasive suffering of formation. So these are the three types of suffering. Suffering of suffering, suffering of change, and suffering of formation. Then there's another way of looking at it is the eight types of suffering. Suffering of birth, aging, sickness, and death. And I've talked about all four of these quite a bit today. Well, I haven't talked so much about sickness and birth yet. We've already been through the suffering of birth in this lifetime, but I think, you know, it can't be pleasant to be squeezed through a birth canal. I mean, it's got to be painful. It's painful for the mother. It's got to be excruciating for the child, too. Illness, yeah, it's easy to understand illness as being suffering. And the fifth type of suffering is a suffering of not getting what you want. The sixth type of suffering is being parted from what is dear to you. The seventh type of suffering is encountering what you dislike. The eighth type of suffering is presented differently in different texts, but in one sutra, the Buddha talks about it as the suffering of formation. There are a couple of different lists of these, and you can find them, but they're all different things. If you think about, in particular, these three, not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, and being separated from what is dear, frankly, most of the suffering, particularly the mental suffering that we experience on a day-to-day level or within our lives, comes down to this. The things that make you go to therapy often come down to this. Now, there's some other things, of course, but it's just part of our lives. Now, the point of thinking about the truth of suffering is not to think, oh, this is terrible, there's nothing we can do about it. The point of thinking about the truth of suffering is to remember we actually can do something about it. And to do something about it, we have to stop the causes of suffering. And that is our ignorance and the afflictions that arise out of that. And in order to do that, we have to follow the path. By following the path, then we'll overcome our ignorance. And when the ignorance is overcome, then we will no longer engage in the actions that perpetuate suffering. But that means we actually have to be diligent about the path. And if we don't remember impermanence, we will not be diligent. Because why do something that's less fun than gelato? Or coffee? Frankly. We're like anyone, we want the immediate rewards. So, in order to remind ourselves, you know, it's like you teach a little kid that, you know, they can't get everything right what they want it, and that sometimes it's better to wait until later to have this special treat or whatever. If you wait till later, then it's better, then it's more happiness. And so it's the same way. If you wait till later, put off the gelato and the coffee and the other things. The gelato and the coffee, again, are small examples, but you know, you can think about the things that you are attached to in this life that prevent you from doing your practice. We contemplated this morning, what is it that stops you from doing your practice? Is it your smartphone? Is it sleep? Is it your cat? What is it? And then you've got to think about why you are so attached to that. But most of all, we have to think about how wonderful an opportunity we have, and take advantage of it now, because frankly, we have no idea what's going to come next. Even if we believe in reincarnation, most of us think that, oh well, next time I'll still come back human. But what's your guarantee of that? So we got a little bit more of the text to go through. Now this section I don't think needs so much commentary, because a lot of it is talking about, actually I see a line that needs commentary right here, but a lot of this is talking about things that apply to monks and people in Tibet. Those whose intention is a wish for emancipation do whatever will liberate themselves from samsara. And bodhisattvas do whatever benefit others. That is what they put into practice. We should act as is taught in the Dharma and teach it as we have practiced it ourselves. If we teach others without practicing it properly ourselves, we are like a leper practicing a Garuda sadhana and no one will listen. In Tibetan medicine, leprosy is caused by nagas. So nagas are like serpent spirits, snake spirits. And they cause leprosy, apparently. Now, nagas, the enemy of nagas are garudas. Garudas are large birds, and they will eat snakes and nagas. So if you practice a Garuda sadhana, you would overcome the nagas who would cause your leprosy. The fact that you still have leprosy is a sign that you have not really accomplished the Garuda sadhana. So anytime a leper comes to you and say, would you like to learn a Garuda sadhana from me? Say, no, thank you. But actually, the point is, you know, if the Dharma teacher hasn't really realized impermanence, okay, then you should all go home because I'm not there. But I should just give up. No one will come to listen. Geshes give their attention to those who are of good birth, rich, assertive, ambitious, able to get things done, good at whatever they do, and highly regarded by their friends and relatives. But they say those with faith who seek Dharma from a fear of death are greedy and unreliable. He's ineffective, shallow, and unreliable, they say. In addition to not helping them, their relatives, families, geshes, kempos, masters, gurus, and companions despise them and try to get rid of them. Assertiveness, wealth, ambitiousness, and being well-connected are antithetical to achieving enlightenment. Those who practice Dharma and are humble see profit, fame, possessions, and sensory pleasures as enemies and faults. Geshes who consider those who have given up on this life to be incapable and will not help them, while paying attention to the wealthy, outspoken, and connected, are not true spiritual friends. An authentic spiritual friend, as described, teaches being the Dharma without material offerings. Thus, they should pay attention to those who practice Dharma properly. A good monk is someone who is fearful of death, diligent, uninterested in this life, and intelligent, and who trusts the Dharma fully. This is because we are fleeing samsara and accomplishing perfect Buddhahood. Hear what says a good monk. A good practitioner is another way you can put it. Because of the social context, Poto was talking about bhikkhus. We have faith in the Buddha and seek the Dharma. Those who are assertive, competent, and ambitious are going further and further away from Buddhahood, thus becoming skillful from today onward in the methods of progressing to Buddhahood itself is what we should call ambition. This is what we should call assertiveness. This is what we should call being good at what you do. Being a good helicopter pilot does not get you any closer to Buddhahood. Being a good salesperson does not get you any closer to Buddhahood. Being a good doctor, if you do not have the attitude of bodhicitta, will not get you closer to bodhicitta. As I mentioned this morning, if you are in a caring or healing profession and you take that opportunity to practice bodhicitta, to develop the wish to achieve Buddhahood for the sake of that patient whom you are seeing right now, then it is brings you closer to Buddhahood. But if you're getting tired and you think, I've got to finish this and get this claim into the insurance form so I can get more money at the end of the day, I need to refer this patient to the lab that is connected to my own practice so that we get more money out of it. I need to keep this in-house. They need 2 tests, but let's order 3. That's getting you further away from Buddhahood. If someone's done with their treatment, then you should say, you're done. You don't need any more. Instead of saying, oh, thank you, come back next week and pay me another $110. So that's what we should call assertiveness, and that's being what you call good at what you do. In terms of a practitioner, that is also being learned. That is being venerable. That is also what is called being a good master. That alone is the method for achieving Buddhahood swiftly. That is the Abhidharma. That is the sutras. That is the Vinaya. That is listening, contemplating, and meditating. That is also bringing together all the arduous austerities and all your capabilities to accomplish Buddhahood. It really comes down to your attitude. If you are doing, because you are still in the worldly life, if you are doing what you do in the worldly life with the intention to bring those people, even if you're doing something, maybe you have a clerical job, and you're wondering, well, how can I do this clerical job in a way that's going to bring people to Buddhahood? Well, when you're doing your clerical job, you still see people in your day. You know, your job might be, if you are a salesperson, people come in, and if instead of thinking, I want to sell them, let's see if I can get them to buy the most expensive X, if you're thinking, what can I do to help this person achieve Buddhahood? Now, it may not, when you bring that, of course, you know, someone comes in and says, yes, I'm looking for a handbag. And you'd say, oh, yes, what can I do to bring you to Buddhahood? They're going to run out. They're going to say, I need the file on X. And you can say, yes, and you also need to practice Dharma. I'm sorry, it's not going to work. But what's important is that you have the, it's not, this is, Dharma is not something to show to others. You don't need to wander around. There are people who go to India and Nepal. They put on white robes. They grow their hair. They have long dreadlocks, and they tie them up. And they sit outside with their drums and their, you know, and their bells. And they do chit practice as if they're sitting in a mountain retreat. When they're sitting in the middle of the square, making a spectacle of themselves. You don't need to walk around with this huge mala around your neck, saying, "I'm this Dharmic practitioner." You don't need to sit here in Portland, you know, advertising yourself as being a Dharma practitioner. But you need to have the attitude. You need to be secret yogis. Unless you're a monk. What am I supposed to do? It's hard to be a secret yogi here. If you're a monk. But you all have that chance. So, you know, Dharma practice is not for showing off. It's for helping other people. And if you have that attitude, there will of course be times when someone will come into your store and after you help them get a handbag that they like, then you might end up in a conversation about something that brings them towards this center or another center. If you bring them on a conversation that brings them to another Dharma center instead of this one, that is wonderful. No sectarianism. You should not think that this Dharma group is the best, even though it is. You shouldn't think that Trungpa Rinpoche is the best, because he is. But whatever brings them, there are different types of Dharma for different people at different stages, and that's why there are so many different Dharma teachings in different Dharma traditions. That's why the text next says, all the sutras, scriptures, and classes of Tantra, from the verses on the Vinaya up to Guhya Samaja, are Dharma for a single individual. So the verses on the Vinaya are the verses, like the first verses that a young monk or nun are taught, the basic rules. Everything from that, the Four Noble Truths, the preliminary practice, the common and special preliminary practices, philosophy, everything. All of that is all practice, going up through all the tantras, all the different types of meditation practices. They're all practices for one individual to do, but we can't do them all at once. So at some point, we'll all be at a place where we should do Kala Chakra practice, for example, or Mahamudra practice, but we may not be there right now. So if we want to get there, if we want to get to the point where we can do Mahamudra or Kala Chakra or whatever practices in your mind, you have to start out with where you are. Because if you try to leap from a worldly point of view to Mahamudra, it's too far. We can't go get that far. So you have to go to that next closest level, which is thinking about the precious human birth. Then the next level is thinking about the death and impermanence. And then you think about the karmic cause and effect and so forth. You build it up slowly as you get through. And then if you do that, you will have a stable foundation. If you have a stable foundation, all the practices you do will go well. If you jump to the highest practice too early, you will not have a stable foundation, and you will not get the results that you should out of the practice. So they're all Dharma for a single individual. They were taught with specific times and stages in mind. There are none that were said to be unnecessary. So you should not think to yourself, well, the teachings about I'm not a monk, I'm not a nun, they're not necessary, forget about them. They're actually necessary, and they may be useful for you in the future, perhaps in this life, perhaps in the next life. But they're all useful for a single individual at different stages on the journey. All the Dharma is the same. If we say our Dharma and their Dharma and then criticize someone else's, we will be reborn in hell. It is said in the Noble 8,000 verses. So we might think, oh, our Dharma is good. Islam is bad. Our Dharma is good. That religion is bad. This is a mistake. We should recognize that, of course, here in the context of Tibetan Buddhism, everyone was Buddhist except for a few Bunpos in the shamanist religion. But pretty much everyone at that time in Tibet was Buddhist. It's a Buddhist culture. But for us, there are lots of Catholics, Presbyterians, Jews, Islam, a lot of Islam in Portland with all the Somali, I imagine, and whatever have you. Everything's here. And so we need to respect all the different traditions. If we say ours is good, theirs is bad, then we're already engaging in the habit of dualistic self and other that's just going to create more suffering, and it's actually antithetical to the Dharma. Islam is good for people at a certain stage. Christianity is good for people at a slightly different stage. Whatever religion is good for people at different stages. All of these religions, have their places, and a lot of them encourage people to do good. Many Muslims will talk about how some Muslims whom I have known and heard about say that being conscious of Allah helps them be conscientious and careful in their daily life, which promotes virtue. Now, this is good. So we cannot say one is good, one is bad. But we have to go further on. Now, at the same time, we can't say the religions that talk about human sacrifice, that we would say comes out of ignorance or animal sacrifice or things like that. when they encourage where the other religions encourage virtuous behavior, then they're good and helpful. Where they encourage unvirtuous behavior, then that's where we should distinguish. But it's, you know, you can't really say good or, what we're talking about is in particular the behavior. It is not right to talk about any individual. This is the hardest one. The best rule is there's only one person we should ever feel free to criticize, and that is yourself. I think if we were all to follow this rule, we would avoid most of the conflicts that occur in our societies. Never criticize anyone than yourself. Other than yourself. Oh, and me. Criticize me because it's helpful to me. Mm-hmm. But don't criticize anyone else. When we look at people, the first thing we normally look for are the faults. We look for the bad things in other people. It's just natural somehow. Immediately you meet someone, it's like, I'm not sure. But actually, you should look for the qualities in other people. As Mikyo Dorje said in another instruction, qualities in other people are as rare as, or even rarer than a Buddha, and should be celebrated as even more valuable. So when you see other people, you should look for their good qualities, and when you look for their good qualities, then you should celebrate them. When you see someone doing something good, someone being generous, someone being kind, then you should really celebrate that quality and rejoice in it, because it's even more rare than Buddhas are in the world. All Dharma is practiced through intention, and we do not know what their intentions are. When we look at people who are focused on this life, it may seem as if they only accomplish things for this life, but there are some who have no thought at all of their own desires and do all they can for the sake of other sentient beings. There are also those who say they are benefiting others but are accomplishing their own aims. Accomplishing one's own aims can also be of benefit to others. So when we're talking about, so I'm talking about all day about thinking about impermanence, giving up on this life, remembering the precious human, to take advantage of this precious human body and the opportunities. And this is for you to think about yourself. It's not for you to think about the other people in the center. You can only do your own Dharma practice. And so it's really looking at yourself. And you have to be careful here, because sometimes, like, you'll have discussions about things, and you might feel like might be helpful to someone to say, well, have you thought about everything being impermanent? Have you thought about the precious human life? That's okay. But when you start going and you say, well, they haven't finished their preliminaries because they never took the four thoughts that turn the mind to heart, you should really be thinking, I haven't gotten anywhere in my Dharma practice because I haven't taken these to heart, because I would not think a thought like that if I had. Right? So, never, it's better, only criticize yourself. Some say it is impossible to have no wishes, but the fault is in their own mind. You shouldn't underestimate the power of our practice. I think we often think to ourselves, I could never get to a point where I have no desires. Of course you can. You have Buddha nature. You can achieve Buddhahood. There's nothing stopping you except yourself. You have to have the confidence that we can do it. And if we have the confidence, we can do it. There's no limit to what we can get done in this life if we decide to do it. And that's why we need to contemplate the thoughts that will motivate us to do it. Some say you need wealth in order to truly practice Dharma. If you lack resources, you need to curry favor with others, but you will not need to if you have wealth. Therefore, having a few things is an aid to the Dharma, they say. But none of them have thought about death. That is what someone who has not gained certainty in the Dharma says. If you do not truly think of and recall death from your heart, the Dharma will never happen. If you do genuinely recall death, there is no way you could bear it mentally. At that point, how could you have any desire to amass things? Some reply that they will use their wealth until they die, and then whoever wants it can take it, or you make the bequest. These are exactly what I call people who are focused on this life. They may have their own wealth and may not need to curry favor with others, but it's certain none of these practitioners will ever practice better than they do now. One needs to put up with a few hardships to achieve perfect Buddhahood. When you buy a large gemstone, you need to put up your own mint money, collateral, and an additional amount. There's no point in them knowing much Dharma. There's no point to profound oral instructions either. So you have to be willing, I mean, at some point when we do Dharma practice, you have to be willing to make the choice. And some of the choices are not going to be comfortable. It may mean moving. It may mean any number of things. It may mean separation from people you love. It may mean that you need to do something for your practice, but it's going to make someone else unhappy. What do you do then? If you have really considered the thoughts that turn the mind, and you are really have real conviction, then things will work out no matter what you do, because you will do what is Dharma, and it will work out. If you have not really taken them to mind, then you're just going to get yourself into a mess. So it's really important to do the contemplations now. You're in this life, you're in a worldly life now, but you can use this life to develop the understanding of the four thoughts that turn the mind. And if you do so, everything you do in the Dharma will go well. If you don't, it'll be difficult. And it won't always be easy either way, but it's like, you know, it's like going to medical school. Not easy, but when you get through medical school, on a worldly level, you're all right. So now we're going through, we're basically going through school to get to Buddhahood. And it's not always going to be easy. Sometimes you have to put in a few extra hours when you're in school. We need to do the same when we are trying for Buddhahood. When you meet a good guru, your mind will likely become the Dharmakaya. Now is the time to look for a good guru, but some say, what good will a guru do? It would be better to do fake meditating. Many people talk like that. You need to gather incalculable accumulations to meet a good guru, so what good will it do now not to look now and instead keep faking it? If you meet a good guru, you will develop samadhi through the guru's blessings. Because of that, you will realize your own mind and awaken to Buddhahood. But some would rather not be criticized than awaken to Buddhahood. Generally, Dharma does not come from ambitiousness and assertiveness. Dharma depends upon faith, diligence, and prajna. Those gathered around a spiritual friend should be there to see how much they can direct their minds towards the Dhamma, not to see who is the most ambitious, who is the most assertive, and who is the biggest swindler. There are those who, when a spiritual master compassionately gives profound Dharma teaching, do not call that compassionate, but if he gives something material, they say he has been compassionate. These days, they criticize those who go looking for a guru and pith instructions. When someone gets a loan of 2 bushels, those who care for them say, things are working out for you over there. You should go and do there. In the meantime, I'll look after your house. But that is a mistake. So they're willing to say, okay, I think this translation might need a little bit of a tweak here. Basically, if you're having a financial problem and you need to go off someplace, people will say, okay, I'll look at your house. I'll take care of things for you while you go and do what you need to do to take care of your finances. I'll take care of things. I'll hold down the fort while you go. You can go and get your education that you need for the degree and then come back. And I'll take care of things here for you. People do that. But when someone says, I need to go and do retreat, do you say that for them? No. You say, why can't I go on retreat? That we will have to leave everything good behind and go off alone is not some tale that we have heard without knowing whether it is true or not. It is plain to see now that people, their eyes agape, leave absolutely everything behind and go. So at the time of death, of course, we don't see that. I mean, this is the problem in our society. Death is so insulated that many of us have never actually been with dying people or seen it. Or if we have seen it, maybe only once or twice in our lifetime. We're so private that we don't let people in to see. But they've gone and they haven't brought anything with them. Yet those who are clever, assertive, and ambitious do not sense this. Even old folks who have reached the age of 80 have ambitions for this life. Now, this is true. They still want to do things. My father still wants to write more articles. That's I hope you can. Although I'm not sure what it'll do. All those with shallow dispositions who act on short-term happiness still have little character. You may say you won't be happy when you're old, but if you only act on ambitions for this life, you'll be even less happy in the next. Some say that you cannot include death in discussions. If you do not include death in your discussions, then you will only think that you won't die. Your thoughts will only be of this life. So you'll think, today I'll do this, tomorrow I'll do that, next year I'll do this, I'll do that in my old age. These are only thoughts of this life. Practitioners should do the opposite and not include immortality in their discussions. Then you can make preparations for death. Our mind should be comfortable at the time of death. We must leave everything good from this life behind and go. So worldly abundance is incompatible with being a practitioner. Now we admire worldly people and they admire us back, but being incompatible with worldly means that instead of admiring them, we should turn our backs on them. Merely not getting married does not help. Merely going to a Dharma center does not help. You must turn your back on the 8 worldly concerns. Gathering merit means that your mind becomes the Dharma, not that you are well respected or have good clothes. You might be sick with leprosy, blind with your hands and feet amputated, your clothes so badly tattered that no one could take hold of them. But if your mind becomes Dharma, that is called accumulating merit. No matter how bad a state you are in this life, if you have control over your mind and direct your mind towards virtue, then everything you do will become virtue. And even if you have not got a single cent to give to anyone, you can still actually gain far more merit than a philanthropist who gives millions. Nowadays, everyone seems to call those who are good at accruing wealth men and women of good character. But I have seen many amass wealth and then die. Even animals know very well how to gather wealth. Marmots know very well how to gather caches of tubers. Bees gather honey. Pikas, that's like rabbits with no tails. Pikas stack hay, and birds construct their nests. If you are generous instead, you will not be reborn as a hungry ghost, and when born in another realm, you will not be poor, as is said in the verses summarizing Prajnaparamita. So how much money do you actually give away? How much do you give away? How much are you willing to give away? And how much do you keep for yourselves? Do you give $20 a month and keep $2,000 or $3,000 for yourself? And call yourself generous? We praise having ambitions for old age, but it would be better to sow a long-lasting crop to that same degree by practicing the Dharma properly. To say you do understand the Dharma is to say that you know the methods to achieve Buddhahood. The words are not the point. Instead of saying you have knowledge of the path, it is better to embark on the path and go. If you do not start practicing right now, you may think that you will meditate after you have made all your preparations, but that time will never come. You will use up your entire life preparing. Some say that Tantra and the Vinaya are exclusive of each other, but they have misunderstood. If something occurs that is an inappropriate basis for the mantra, it is not the Vinaya. If something occurs that violates the Vinaya, it is a sign of it not being the secret mantra. To reap harvest in the fall, you must sometimes irrigate the field, and sometimes you must till it and make furrows. In doing so, you concentrate all your efforts, and the furrows yield a crop. So you need to actually practice. You need to follow the steps, the different stages of the practice. Sometimes you do one practice, sometimes you do the next. But if you try to harvest the crop in April, you aren't going to get anything. You have to plant the seeds in April. You have to till the furrows. You have to plant the crop. You have to make sure that it's watered and irrigated, and then it'll grow, and then you could reap the harvest. Likewise, we need to begin with contemplating the 4 thoughts that turn the mind. We need to go through all the meditation practices, and in the end, we will get a result. If we are diligent, we will get it in this life. If not, we will be liberated in the. Then we might be liberated in the bardo, or at the very least, achieve a good basis for the body that is a good basis for practicing the Dharma in the future. But if we leave it off thinking, I'm going to wait to practice the Dharma till later, that later never comes. It's like Janis Joplin says, tomorrow never happens, man. It's always the next day. No, what? I can't say what she said.
It's always the same day.
It's always the same effing day. Geshe's who know Dharma well all love to talk. They do not initially practice Dharma out of a fear of death. They study and learn, thinking that they should at least avoid being criticized by people, be well respected, and be called a teacher, elder, bhikshu, or geshe. Then the monasteries, stewards, and insiders will have to curry favor with him. They take full ordination and pretend to be especially venerable so that everyone will call them practitioners. They first study the scriptures a bit, get a few pith instructions, and then they say they practice meditation. They make use of various methods to gain a higher position in the ranks than anyone else and have jostling crowds exclaim, "What an amazing geshe!" Such geshes are, and so forth are so focused on the hubbub of fame and lack any of the causes and conditions for liberation from samsara. And it's not just monks. It's anyone who's practicing the Dharma. And in this society, since there are so few monks, it's people who go out and they practice Dharma, and you get a position in some Dharma organization, then you get to be well-known and liked, and then you become a teacher who teaches these programs and that program, and moving up. And I don't see that a whole lot in this Sangha, but it's a danger. Think, I know something about the Dharma. I can help others. What do you know about the Dharma? How much have you practiced? You have to be realistic and honest with yourself. This is why I only talk about impermanence. I haven't even realized that. What good is a teacher learned in Dharma that is not an antidote for the five poisons? What can cure an illness that cannot be remedied by medicine? What will high regard, good management, and work do for you if you have not extinguished your own wishes and developed conviction in karma, karmic results deep within? What will acting venerably do for you if you are not revolted by samsara and sensory pleasures? Who can fool the Lord of Death's mirror of karma? The way it's talked about in the Buddhist sort of, you could call it mythology, is that at the time of death you pass away, and then in the bardo you go, and then you encounter Yama, the Lord of Death, who shows you the mirror of your karma, the actions of what you've done. There's no way to lie to Yama, because everything that you have done appears clearly in that mirror, and then because of what you have done, you are sent to where you need to go. That's sort of the myth. Maybe there is a sort of Yama figure that appears in the bardo, but it really is what's happening in your own mind. What's going on in your mind? What habits have you developed in this life? What habits from previous lives have you overcome? What are you doing now to bring your mind to virtue? How many steps have you taken towards Buddhahood now in this lifetime? How many steps backwards have you taken? Have the steps backward been big steps? And the steps forward been baby steps. There's a certain similarity. One of my good friends and I joke about me always talking about fire and brimstone. And we also talk about me being a Dharma fundamentalist, an extremist. And I'm the Dharma curmudgeon. But you have to look honestly. This is different than... It's not popular to talk about the hells, the hungry ghosts, bad actions, reaping results from bad actions. It's not... People don't like to hear it. Particularly for so many of us who, we're reacting against that. There's this, the tradition of Catholics, who feel so guilty about a lot of things, and people want to run away from that sense of guilt. Or in Protestantism, like the Calvinist, thou shalt not, or you will burn in hell fire forever. But it's a little bit different, because there's no one judging you. There's no need to beat yourself up. You have to do what you can. You have no choice but to do what you can, or you will pay for it later. But not because anyone is punishing you. It's like if you smoke cigarettes, you will probably die some horrible death of cancer or emphysema or something. I mean, it's unless you're hit by a truck first or killed in war or whatever. But, you know, it's clear that there are things, there are causes that will lead to unpleasant results. It's not that someone's judging you. It's because you are doing it to yourself. And you don't have to. You can take the opportunity to do good things now. You can train yourself, train your intentions, train in compassion, train in bodhicitta, develop the real motivation of the Mahayana. And you can go towards Buddhahood. It doesn't really matter. If you take what Geshe Poto is saying to heart, maybe you don't need to leave this life, but you may well want to. If you take impermanence in the precious human life to heart, you will do everything in your power to achieve Buddhahood now. You haven't got a choice because we haven't got a tomorrow. Who knows what's going to happen tomorrow? What good is a Geshe who doesn't even have a smidgen of bodhicitta or altruism that really desires the eight concerns? Who will you appoint your helper and friend in sorrow when you experience the ripening of your wrong actions as suffering? You should have thought differently and avoided pursuing only sensory pleasures and greatness in this life, but you did not. You have not done whatever you could to develop the Dharma in your own or anyone else's being. You have not tried to focus your attitude on the immediate, and that is at fault. We need to do right now what is most important. If the house is in fire, you leave it. Then you call the fire department. You get out of the smoke. If you have bodhicitta, you bring everyone else out with you. But you got to get out of that house. We have to escape the suffering of samsara. I mean, how long are we going to do this? We can come to Dharma groups once a week and do all this, but how much progress are we actually making? If we're making progress or if we're not making progress, it really depends upon our motivation. If we're really motivated, we're going to do something with our lives. And most of us were, you know, I mean, I really feel, I look back on what I've done and the opportunities I've had, and here I still am in this position. How much further do I need to go? And I think I begin to know it. Then I get distracted. And I'm distracted for a week or two. And it's like this over and over again. This is why we have to keep contemplating this, keep practicing, keep thinking about impermanence. Because if we don't, we're going to get distracted. And then it will be too late. Making this life most important and practicing Dharma on the side will not work, but no one will listen. If you do not recall death, you will do whatever is most profitable in this life. You will even be able to violate your guru's commands if they do not measure up to your ambitions. If it seems it will profit you in this life, you will pretend to be so faithful and so devoted to your guru. Deep down, this annoys me. The verse, so hard to gain these leisures and resources, should be enough on its own, but no one realizes that. This is a verse from the Way of the Bodhisattva. There are many translations of it. And this verse translation here, I reworked it a little bit yesterday. And it's here on the bottom of it. I've gained what is so difficult to find, the leisures and resources that benefit beings. If I do not accomplish good in this, how will I ever come to them again? So what is so difficult to find is the opportunity we have as humans who have come in contact with the Dharma. We all have the precious human life. We have that. This is the basic physical basis for being able to practice the Dharma. The fact that you are coming here now shows that you also have the mental basis, which is faith. With these two, we can actually go all the way. But if we don't, if we just leave it at that, what's going to happen next? So we have these leisures and resources that will bring benefit to beings. This body is the boat that will bring us to Buddhahood and help us benefit all innumerable sentient beings. But if we don't use it well now, if you don't put your foot in the boat, you won't get to the other side of the ocean. You have to get in, and then you have to row. You actually have to go across. Otherwise, you know, what good does it do to have this boat? So if I do not accomplish good in this, how will I ever come to get them again? So we fritter this life away. Who knows what's going to happen to us? The mirror of the Lord of Death's mirror of karma shows us not only what we've done in this life, but what we've done in past lives. Oh, who knows what we did in those past lives? We've got to take advantage of our opportunity now. But no one realizes, this should be enough on its own, but no one realizes that. They don't even seek the Dharma. They hope for the merit of the Dharma from their knowledge of the profane. That is profoundly mistaken, but they do not understand. They deserve sympathy. So it's not a question of looking down on people. Sympathy, you should, when we see worldly people who don't know about Dharma and who are not in a position where they can, I mean, we can't go around knocking on people's doors. Would you like to read it? Would you like to read Geshe's long soliloquy with me? I'm sorry, that's not the Buddhist way. But when people come, of course, we can help. But we can, a lot of people just aren't able to hear it. And this is really something we should feel compassion for them. We should make there might be ways that we can really help them. If we can't help them, we should make aspirations. May I develop the qualities to be able to truly help this being. If you do not turn your mind away from this life, your fear of being badly off in old age will prevent you from being generous. Even to keep discipline, you must have no desires, but fearing being badly off in old age breeds desire. Therefore, without eliminating desires for this life, you will not perfect the accumulations. So it is important to give up on this life. It is important to give up on this life. It is important to give up on this life. I say this three times. This contains all the crucial points of the Dharma. This is how you should distinguish samsara from nirvana. All lasting ambitions begin with this. This suppresses all faults. It is important to give up on this life. But when you give up on this life, you have to really do it. You have to really do it from your heart. You can't fake it. You can't go off in a cave and pretend. You have to develop the qualities inside. So it's important for right now to really contemplate these four thoughts, the precious human life. It's so important to realize this. If you realize this one thing, then everything else will naturally happen. It suppresses all faults. The foundations of all joy and goodness must be laid on this. It is crucially important to abandon all thoughts of this life. You have no chance if you do not. There, what get you into all the suffering, so you must eliminate them in whatever way you can. Before we start to practice Dharma, none of us practitioners have much attachment to wealth and things, but we seldom yearn for those close to us. We do not want to pay attention to work or tasks, but once someone enters the Dharma, they make profane ambitions the most important. They show up for the detailed work and when it's time to be stingy. Even if they cannot do anything else, they spread the word, speak badly, and bear bad omens. At the very least, they act as the messenger. It's like you want to become the official in the Dharma Center so you can keep tabs on other people, and or in the monastery, you want to know what everyone else is doing. You're looking at other people, you're criticizing other people, and you're not looking at yourself. There is only one person you can change, and that is yourself. If you change that one person, then you will become like Trungpa Rinpoche, like the Gyawan Karmapa, like the Buddha. You have that potential, but you have to start with yourself. They go into excessive detail on their possessions, and when doing business, they will go to a degree too difficult for anyone else. When made to practice the Dharma, what they think of is riches. They only do what they're not made to. This, too, is because of not remembering death. If you practice Dharma properly, your Dharmas will all be dear to you. It will make all those close to you feel good. All the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas grant their blessings to that. This satisfies the wishes of all the gurus and spiritual friends. The gods and Dharma protectors will fulfill all your ambitions, and all your intentions will be accomplished as you wish. Therefore, understanding that your mind becoming Dharma alone is the most critical point. You must know how to bring all the Buddha's words and classes of scriptures to bear upon your mind alone. So everything you, all the Dharma you teach, it's not some abstract thing. It's not unrelated. You have to take the teachings and you have to apply it to your experience. So when we talk about the truth of suffering, the samsaric aggregates are suffering. What is this for you? What is this in your body? Why is your body suffering? Why are the other aggregates suffering? Why is your mind suffering? Why is pleasure suffering? Why is gelato suffering? Those who currently are the equals or superiors of their peers, who are eminent and well-known, may seem prominent now, but they too will definitely die. When they die, there will be a difference. If you make being prominent in this life important, you will lose it in the next life. To bring it together and wrap it up, we must have no regrets at the time of death. When we are stricken with a fatal illness and know we will not escape, it is too late to say, I am not destined to die like this. I have something better to do than this. If this old ghost doesn't die, I really will genuinely practice the Dharma. It's too late. Your deathbed is too late, and we don't know when the deathbed's going to happen. The only chance we have is right now. If you are able to prepare well now, you will be fine at the time of death. But you have to make sure that you will be. It's up to you. Therefore, stoking the fires of desire now is no help. We are wandering in samsara, but have the opportunity to awaken to Buddhahood. This brief life will definitely run out. Therefore, we must give up on this life and genuinely practice the Dharma. Even though I do not think it will help anyone else, I could not help but say this to myself. If this was not from the heart, punish me. This is Guru Potowa's long soliloquy, the ultimate evidence of practicing the Dharma. Wow. So I don't know, maybe you all have questions or... I mean, it's not intellectually difficult. Really. This is the problem. We want to do the high practices. We want to do Mahamudra. We want to study Madhyamaka. We want to study all this. We want to skip over all the foundation to get there. And if we skip over all that, we may think we understand it. We may have some intellectual understanding, but we'll never really incorporate it into the being. The purpose of practicing the Dharma is to change our mental habits, to incorporate the Dharma into our being, to really become, to become generosity, become patience, become discipline. It's not something else from who you are. It's really bringing out qualities that we have, and the only way we can do that is by really devoting ourselves to it 200%, as much as we can. And it's so easy not to. We only have right now. So one thing that the Gyalon Karmapa once told me is that when you sit down to do your practice, you recite the Bodhicitta prayer, but you need to think to yourself, I need to achieve Buddhahood right now, on this seat, in this session. You need to really have this strong intention. If you have that strong intention when you sit down and practice, then your practice will have a lot more. It's like you're giving it a lot of oomph at the beginning, a lot of impetus. If it's just like saying, Sanjay Jadan Sachi Jananadam, oh yeah, okay. That's nice. It's better than nothing. But to really think, I need to do it now and in this lifetime, in this, on this very seat, in this very session, it's really important. That's so easy to forget. Yes.
I had a question about the danger of falling into the lower realms in spite of our Buddhist practice, whatever it might be. And did I hear a teaching correctly one time that when one takes the Bodhisattva vow, that automatically prevents one from going to the lower realms. Is that a good understanding? Or can we still blow it?
Yeah, you can blow it. Yeah, you can break the bodhisattva vow. And then you're really blowing it. But this is one of the benefits that is listed of the bodhisattva vow. It's also a benefit listed of the refuge vow. The dharma is protection. We say this in the meal chant. The unsurpassable protector is the precious dharma, or the true dharma. The unsurpassable protector is the true dharma does not mean that, you know, you've got the dharma shield of approval. And that this is going to protect you from the lower realms. The way the Dharma protects you from the lower realms is because you practice it. If you don't practice the Dharma, it will not protect you from the lower realms. If you say that you have taken the Bodhisattva vow, but you act in ways that are against the Bodhisattva vow, then there's no way the fact that you said it once, of course it's good, but it's not going to, that protection is not going to work. You have to practice the Dharma for it to protect you from the lower realms. Simply, you can look at yourself in your mind stream and say, what is the relative proportion of positive love, loving-kindness, compassion, bodhicitta, rejoicing, generosity, what is the balance between the virtues and the annoyance, disturbance, greed, hatred, attachment, all of the negative mindsets? Of your thoughts per day, what's the balance? If you find yourself going on this side, you got to correct it. You want it to be all on this side. You want to be all on the positive side. But if you find yourself the negative overwhelming, then you have to do something to correct it, and that's practicing the Dharma. So Dharma is the greatest protection from the lower realms, but no one is going to actually do it for you. And Dharma doesn't protect you as long as you leave it out of your heart. If the Dharma is staying in your intellect and not incorporated into your heart, and then once it's in your heart, it'll naturally express itself from your actions. It's not doing that, then yeah, you got a problem. But if you take the Bodhisattva vow and you live up to the Bodhisattva precepts, then that means that you're taking the Bodhisattva vow to heart. And you're acting on the precepts of not giving up on any sentient being.
Makes me think of the idea of, say, most people here, for example, don't put out a lot of negative energy in terms of body and speech.
Yeah.
But internally, we have wild thoughts and
thoughts. That's right.
And so, what's the weight? I always think that there's less weight and consequence.
Yes, that is true. I mean, they develop more weight and they're what we call karmic paths, but they're not actual karma. They're paths because they get you to do actions, but they're not actual actions themselves. And when you actually commit the action, then it becomes stronger. It's like thinking about smoking a cigarette will not get you addicted. But when you think about smoking a cigarette and then you start, then you're down the road. But we still need to be careful of that. And, you know, who knows what actions we have hanging over us from the past. But, you know, I mean, yeah, okay, this is fire and brimstone. This is the, and this is the scare you sort of thing. But if you aren't scared, you aren't going to take it to heart, because you're going to get lazy. And even more, think of everyone else who doesn't know how to do this. know. This may be too intense. But I want to thank you all for coming today, and I don't, you know, and whether it was worthwhile or not, you know. If you look in yourselves, whether you make it worthwhile or not. But whether it's worthwhile or not also depends on what we do at the ending. Whenever you do something, when you sit down and do a meditation practice, sometimes, you know, it feels like, okay, I'm almost done, I've got these three verses, and I'm done, and okay, thup, off. No, you need to take your time at the end. It's really important to actually finish and dedicate the merit, and really take your time instead of just immediately jumping off and doing something. You need to really look in yourself. And so that's why we always close with dedications of the merit. And so now we have spent a day doing our Calvinist Buddhist the extremist Buddhist fundamentalist day. And if there's any good that has come from this teaching and listening and contemplating, then may that merit bring all sentient beings to the point where they can turn their thoughts from this life to the thoughts of Dharma. May they be able to take the Dharma into their hearts and become Buddhas. May they be free of all the sufferings. The sufferings that we experience are the sufferings that all sentient beings experience. So by us doing this good now, may all sentient beings be free of this suffering. We recite a short 4-line dedication prayer, but if you think about it, it has everything. By this merit, may I attain omniscience, the state of Buddhahood, defeating the enemy wrongdoing. So this is attaining the perfect benefit for yourself. Through the practice, we achieve Buddhahood. That is the greatest benefit. It frees, we overcome wrongdoing, and we achieve the state of Buddhahood. Because of that, then we become able to free all sentient beings from the stormy, from the churning waves of birth, aging, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara. And so, from now until they achieve, by this merit, may all sentient beings achieve the state of Buddhahood. And until such time, may they be free of all forms of suffering. May they be free of birth, aging, sickness, death, famine, war, strife, lamentation, wailing, grief, sorrow, pain of any sort. May they have the opportunity to encounter some genuine spiritual master. I don't really think it's important that the master call themselves Buddhist or not, but someone who can guide them on the path to Buddhahood. You may call it by a different name, but come to the path of Buddhahood. Is it all sentient? May they meet these masters. May they properly follow the path. May they practice virtue, give up misdeeds, tame their minds, and become Buddhas. And so please dedicate the virtue from this teaching and listening today to this end. So I see you, you have a basket here that is obviously intended for me. If you give it to me, I'm going to give it all away. You can keep it for yourselves and give it to someone whom you like. So thank you very much. The only thanks I need is that you just keep this in mind and think about it as much as you can.